banks of America that the government had major concerns about?
Look, I think the Biden administration was afraid that there would be a wider contagion, that people would see one bank's depositors lose their uninsured money and that other people would start pulling their money out of the banks. Now, to my mind, what's insane about this situation is that this bank had, I think, north of 90% of the deposits in the bank were uninsured, which is insane because FDIC insurance is a kind of well-known thing, $250,000 limits, and there are ways to do all sorts of financial management, risk management, where you can have a lot of money in a bank, but not 90% of your money, whether you're a business or anything else, is not uninsured. So the failure of risk management practices on many of these depositors, a bank, again, 90% of the deposits being uninsured, really shows, I think, a cavalier attitude by some of these depositors who must have either not done any risk management at all or simply presumed that they would have the political power and wherewithal to get the government in a crisis, that the government would swoop in and insure those uninsured deposits. As we reported at The Lever, what's very telling here when we talk about deposit insurance is that Silicon Valley Bank's lobby groups in Washington fought against a proposal to shore up federal deposit insurance for the relatively depleted deposit insurance fund, the fund that will now guarantee those depositors' deposits. The point being that if we're going to have a discussion about extending deposit insurance and extending those limits and making sure that those limits, larger limits, apply to everybody, there is a deposit insurance fund. There's about $120 billion in that deposit insurance fund against $10 trillion of insured deposits in America. And it's been the bank lobby that has fought against proposals that does not want to have to put in more money, does not want to have to pay those insurance premiums to make sure all of those deposits are covered. So we're in a situation where bank regulators swoop in a kind of haphazard way when they see a bank, when the decision is made for a particular bank to swoop in and backstop the uninsured deposits. But it's not clear whether those guarantees extend to the entire banking system. There's a question of, is it fair to guarantee the deposits of uninsured depositors at a bank like Silicon Valley Bank, but not extend those guarantees to everybody else?
And Mercer Baradaran, what about this issue of the federal deposit insurance? From what I understand, 96% of Americans don't have $250,000 to put into a savings account. So we're talking about a very small percentage of the American people that are actually affected, even by the loss of money, if they have more than $250,000 in a bank. Why has the government, for instance, not even raised the as David was saying, raised the minimum insurance a little higher rather than now apparently go outside of its legal authority to say we're going to insure all depositors at these banks?
Yeah. So this is a good question. And yes, something I said yesterday, there's two kind of lies, right? There's white lies and there are FDIC insurance limits, because FDIC insurance limits are not meant to be they are technically legal, but there's never been a crisis, as far back as you go, except for the Great Depression, where there wasn't FDIC insurance, that the limit caused a problem. During 2008, also, we had a 100,000 limit, and they just raised it because it's not about what money is insured. It's a panic is a psychological phenomenon. So if I'm going to lose $100 to, $1,000, some people are going to take their money out no matter what, because, it's your money. We're not talking about sort of like calculations. No one's sitting on their couch and being like, should I go to the bank? It's only $50,000. It really is. You have to insure all of it or none of it. And so I've always understood the $250,000 limit as like a suggestion for, how to move your money around. But in a panic, of course, there's going to be a bailout. And it's not going to be through the FDIC insurance. It's through 13-3 Fed powers. This is all Federal Reserve. The systemic risk engines are on. And those engines are much more powerful than the FDIC engines. But I do want to say something about the ex ante. Why was all of this stuff allowed to happen? And this is where we get to regulation. And David said, the haphazardness. That also is not accidental. I have personal experience having been a nominee in the Biden administration and seeing the other nominees come through. We have not gotten the Biden administration was not able to appoint a OCC regulator. They have an acting for that for the FDIC when that position came open. I mean, Trump's appointees vacated, and you know, they had to move things around for the FDIC. They had to bring someone from the board who's already confirmed and put them in, you know. And then for the OCC, none of the nominees that we got vetted got, you know, could get enough support. And so these are things that we, you know, regulators, if we had been in those positions, would have done very differently and very quickly. These are problems that we all knew about. And I think it's not just that there's a haphazardness. There isn't really a forward motion. It's defense, because the industry really is quite powerful across the board. And it's not that the industry is there's community banks over here and there's big banks, but at times there's just, you know, one incentive, which is sort of deregulation, you know, let's work out deals rather than create a lot of rigid rules and hierarchies. And especially for banks like Silicon Valley Bank, which, you know, they weren't doing anything Lehman-like. They weren't doing anything, they weren't doing anything more risky than any other bank right now. It's just that banks have runs. That's how banks work. And especially in a market like this where interest rates are going up, you know, they have bonds, you have the crypto thing. Who knows what sort of one or two, three things cause the domino effect, but that is the nature of banking. It's risk, and it's susceptible to runs like this.
Let's go back to the 2018 Trump-era law, when Trump rolled back some banking regulations. Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke out against the bill that Trump signed off on, but Democrats and Republicans voted for it. This was her on the Senate floor before the vote.
So I will make a prediction. This bill will pass. And if the banks get their way in the next 10 years or so, there will be another financial crisis. Of course, when the crash comes, the big banks will throw up their hands and say, it's not their fault. Nobody could have seen it coming. And then they'll run to Congress and beg for bailout money. And let's be blunt, they'll probably get it. But just like in 2008, there will be no bailout for working families. Jobs will be lost, lives will be destroyed. The American people, not the banks, will once again bear the burden.
And Senator Elizabeth Warren, of course, proved to be right. I wanted to go to David Sirota, one of the pieces in Lever News. 8 years before the second largest bank failure in American history occurred this week, the bank's president personally pressed Congress to reduce scrutiny of his financial institution, citing the low-risk profile of our activities and business model. Can you take it from there? Tell us, who is the CEO of SVB? And also talk about Barney Frank.
Sure. Greg Becker, the Silicon Valley president, submitted testimony when Congress was looking at whether to weaken the then-current Dodd-Frank law. And what he was particularly pushing for was to raise the thresholds by which banks were subject to stricter scrutiny. So there was a $50 billion threshold. If a bank was bigger, had more assets than $50 billion, it faced higher capital requirements and more granular and more stringent stress tests to make sure that the bank wouldn't fail. Ultimately, Greg Becker, and he was not alone, but he and the banking industry got their way, raising that threshold for Silicon Valley Bank and other similarly sized banks. And Greg Becker, as one example, just to use him as an example, I mean, he held a fundraiser at his home for Democratic Senator Mark Warner of Virginia. And soon after, Mark Warner was one of those Democrats who, in that vote that Elizabeth Warren was talking about, was one of those Democrats that joined with 50 Republicans to pass that bill that raised those thresholds, that ultimately meant that a bank like Silicon Valley Bank was not subjected by law, by rule, by Federal Reserve regulatory authority, was not subjected to the kinds of risk management and risk assessment that it would have been subjected to under the existing Dodd-Frank law. You mentioned Barney Frank.
Let me
Frank.
Just interrupt for a second, David, because we have Senator Mark Warner. He was questioned by ABC This Week host Martha Raddatz over the weekend and asked if he regretted his 2018 vote to repeal parts of the Dodd-Frank Act. This is Senator Warner.
Do you regret that vote? Martha, I still think we put in place Dodd-Frank. I was proud to be one of the key authors of that bill. It strengthened the banking system. I do think these mid-sized banks needed some regulatory relief. End of the day, Martha, no matter what the capital had been in this bank, if you don't get banking 101 straight, if you don't manage your interest rate risks, if you've then got to run at $42 billion in a single day, unprecedented. That
so, Senator,
a valuable asset to somebody who's going to
you don't regret that vote.
Listen, I think that was called the 2155 bill. I think it put in place an appropriate level of regulation on mid-sized banks.
David Sirota, your response to the Democratic Senator Mark Warner, who joined with the Republicans, along with, I think, 16 other Democratic senators, in weakening the the Frank Dodd bill.
What you're seeing there is the power of the banking industry. You're seeing the power of Wall Street right there. A U.S. senator who voted to deregulate Silicon Valley Bank goes on television and continues defending it, defending the deregulation that his donors wanted, defending it even in the face of a bank failure, a bank that pushed for that deregulation that got itself exempted. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the power of the banking industry in Congress. It is so powerful that even a Democratic senator will go on television after a bank failure from a bank that was exempted from those more stricter, stringent rules, will go on television and defend that bill. Now, I'm glad to see that Congresswoman Katie Porter and others have said that they are going to put forward legislation to reverse what happened, what Mark Warner, as an example, supported. And that's a good thing. And there's as we talked about before, there's talk of extending deposit insurance. But the thing that has to happen, in my view, is that if you're going to extend deposit insurance, and you need to, one, make sure the banks put up the money for more of that insurance, and two, that insurance has to come with stronger regulations on these banks so that they cannot gamble with depositors' insurance, and that regulators can know that there aren't going to be bank failures as this proceeds.
And Barney Frank, if you could answer that question, the author of the Frank Dodd bill.
Yeah, I mean, that's an incredible story there. You've got the author of the Dodd-Frank bill who then gets on the board of a bank that was this weekend shuttered. So it shows, in my view, it shows the revolving door here between the policymakers and the banks that are trying to weaken policy. It's almost a two on. If you put it into a movie about corruption, your screenwriter would say you can't put that in. It's too on the nose. It's too ridiculous for the author of the bill to be on the board of a bank that was just shuttered.
And Mercer Baradaran, I wanted to ask you. David Sirota mentioned Greg Becker, the CEO of this failed bank. He was also a member of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco until this weekend. Could you talk about the role of the Federal Reserve Bank? Because some people are claiming that it's the rapid interest rate hikes of the Federal Reserve Bank that is leading to some of the stresses in some of these banks.
Right. Well, the Federal Reserve does a variety of things, but one of the things that it does, so one is the monetary policy. That's the interest rate hikes. That's actually just the bank's fault. Everyone on the market knew that the rates were going up, and they just screwed up. Who has any explanation for why? Maybe they don't understand how banks work, but the bonds that they held on for way too long. So that's just a bad mistake. But as far as the Fed's supervisory role, right? So the Fed has the monetary policy, but the Fed is actually the person who, the entity that is supposed to look at these systemic risks. So it's not just the FDIC. The FDIC manages just insurance, which is a very, very tiny portion of actually what causes a bank run. None of the banks in 2008 that were in the shadow banking sector, none of them had depositors. Just, you know, Citigroup maybe had a little bit, but Lehman and Goldman and all these, they were not even bank holding companies at the time. And so the FDIC is kind of a small, very small fish now in the big pond of banking regulators, especially since the financial crisis. But since the financial crisis, one of the things that was decided was, look, you have these companies like AIG and these non-banks and that are causing these crises, that are doing banking. And so there was this, you know, the SIFI exception, the systemically important financial institutions, where everyone has to do systemic risk stress testing. I mean, even at the time, you know, I've written about these laws for 10 years. Even at the time, I think those laws were very weak meager responses to the financial crisis. They didn't do it. But this bank got an exception from those laws, the systemic risk, sort of that stress testing thing. It's supposed to be above a certain $50 billion or something. You get certain different requirements. And that, the Crapo bill in 2018, the one that Warren was talking about, very presciently saying this would be unprecedented, which is what exactly what this president said. You know, that bill essentially took these carved out exceptions for some of these banks, including this one, for the reasons of, you know, it's better for communities, right? And it's better for small loans and things like that. And so now we're using, I think, in a very cynical way, unfortunately, it is true that we have a glut of community banks in this country. It is true that we've got five major banks and they're not lending those small to mid-sized accounts. And so we do need regulatory relief, whatever that means in that language, to help these small banks. But that's not what this was. This was a loophole. This was an exception for not a community bank. These were venture capital funds. They need the money. I mean, Silicon Valley, all of these companies need someone to service their finances. But that's just a symptom of a broken financial system. It's sort of rent-seeking everywhere you go. And J.P. Morgan will probably buy this bank. And who knows if they'll give the same services as SVB Bank did.
Finally, on a different subject, David Sirota is founder of Lever News, which has been doing so much on East Palestine, and there might be some parallels. You've looked at the last month's toxic train derailment. Do you see a link between the rollback of railway safety regulations and banking regulations? And talk specifically about the rail lobbyist turned senator who could block the safety bill.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's plenty of parallels here. I mean, the crisis happens. There is a push for regulation. Then people forget, or the politicians hope people forget. And then there's a deregulatory push. On the rail situation, there was a spate of derailments in the 2014-2013 that prompted a push for more regulation. When that push for regulation happened, chemical industry lobbyists essentially weakened the rules to make sure that trains like the one in Ohio were not classified as high-hazard flammable trains, made sure that they weren't subjected to those tougher rules. So you can see the parallel there with the banks. Again, a push to not subject the banks to tougher rules, a push to not subject the rail companies to tougher rules. A disaster happens. Now there's a push for new regulations, rightly so, in my view. The Rocana bill with Chris DeLuzio from Pennsylvania in the House, there's a bipartisan bill in the Senate, but there's already been an effort to slow walk them. And that effort to slow walk them has been led, as we reported at The Lever, spearheaded by John Thune, the Republican senator who's the number two ranking Senate Republican, who was literally a registered lobbyist for a railroad company and who has spearheaded in the past the effort to stop these regulations. We have been doing this reporting. It's important to hold these politicians, their feet to the fire, whether it's Mark Warner or John Thune. We hope Democracy Now! Viewers will help us. You can find all our work at levernews.com/democracynow to help us continue doing this reporting. Because, Amy, your question is exactly right. Who are the politicians who are playing the role to stop the regulatory policies that need to be put in place after these crises? I guarantee you, whether it's on rail issues or whether it's on banking issues, there will be even, you saw Mark Warner on financial stuff, you will see John Thune on rail stuff, that even in the aftermath of a disaster, these lobbies are so powerful that they have people in places like the U.S. Senate to stop anything from happening. And the only way anything will happen, whether it's on rail safety or on regulating the banks, will be if enough people actually respond and demand that their lawmakers take action.
David Sirota, I want to thank you for being with us, founder of The Lever, and we'll link to The Lever at democracynow.org. And Marisa Baradaran, banking law professor at the University of California, Irvine. Progressive groups at one point backed Baradaran as the Biden administration's pick for controller of the currency, which is an influential regulator of banks. Next up, an independent autopsy of the activists shot dead while protesting the construction of Cop City in Atlanta suggests that they were sitting cross-legged with their hands in the air when police shot Tortuguita 14 times, killing him. We'll speak to the family's attorney and hear from their parents. Stay with us. Fly by our native daughters. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we turn to Georgia, where a newly released independent autopsy of the activists fatally shot by Atlanta police in January concludes their hands were raised up and in front of their body when they were killed, Georgia State Patrol shot Manuel Esteban Terán, who's known as Tortuguita, and uses the they-them pronouns, during a raid on an encampment of forest protectors who oppose the construction of Atlanta's $90 million police training center dubbed Cop City, the largest such police training center if built in the country. The independent autopsy released Monday at a news conference by Tortuguita's family shows the 26-year-old activist was likely seated cross-legged when they were shot 14 times. This is Tortuguita's father, Joel Paez, speaking Monday at a news conference in Decatur, Georgia.
My child was an upstanding individual that gave his life for others. They gave his life for his ideals. They defend the environment. They convince others with conviction and also with understanding and never with violence. My child is a hero.
Tortuguita's family has sued the city of Atlanta after the release of more video evidence of the shooting of their child was blocked. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation, or GBI, alleges Tortuguita fired on an officer first during the raid and was killed by return fire, but says there's no body cam footage of the shooting. At Monday's news conference, Tortuguita's mother, Belkis Terán, called on the GBI to release its investigative report into the killing.
My child, Manuel Esteban Paez Terán, was killed here in Atlanta on the 18th of January, 2023. We still do not know anything. It was killed, our most beloved family member and the most caring person that any group of people could have, and there is only silence. Manuel loved the forest, gave them peace. They meditate there. The forest connects them with God. I never thought that Manuel could die in a meditation position. My heart is destroyed. I invest so much time, care, and dedication to educate my children to become active members of a society. I gave them love and compassion as tools to make the world a better place. But now there is no answer. Answers. I try to be strong, to continue Manuel's legacy for the love of my family and for all those love Manuel. I want answers for my child homicide. I'm asking for answers to my child homicide. I am suffering for my right to this answer, and that I have not been given, and I deserve answers. Thank you.
That's Belkis Teran, the mother of Manuel Tortuguita Teran, speaking Monday. Just the day before, she and other family members joined activists to spread Tortuguita's ashes in a memorial ceremony in Willani People's Park. For more, we go to Atlanta to speak with Jeff Filipovits, the civil rights attorney representing Teran's family. Welcome to Democracy Now! Jeff, if you could start off by talking about what you understand happened at this point and the meditation position that Tortuguita's mom was talking about. How is it that the autopsy showed that Tortuguita was sitting in a cross-legged position with arms up? The police say that Tortuguita shot them.
Thank you. It's good to be here. So I want to be clear about what the autopsy shows and what it doesn't show, because the autopsy does not give us the conclusive answers that all of us hope that it does. The autopsy shows exit wounds on the palms of both of Manuel Teran's hands and shows wounds to their legs that are consistent with being seated in a cross-legged position when that shot was fired. But the autopsy doesn't answer the question about what happened in the moments leading up to the shooting. And when we're talking about police use of force, and especially police use of deadly force, those moments can be determinative. A fraction of a second can make all of the difference in the world. And so while we're trying to shed light on and bring public knowledge to everything that has happened as much as we can, ultimately, until the GBI explains to us what happened, releases their witness interviews, and releases any other evidence that they have, we're not going to be able to piece this together.
Well, what about the issue of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation asking the city to hold off on releasing more video footage? What is the reason they're giving for that?
Well, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation is invoking the pending investigation exception to the Georgia Open Records Act. But the city of Atlanta makes its own independent decision as to whether to release videos. And so the city began releasing videos, promised to release videos on an ongoing basis, and only after the GBI contacted the city did the city change its mind and decide not to release those videos. It's part of a pattern of locking down information so that we cannot figure out what happened. The GBI certainly has the duty to interview witnesses without disclosing to each of those witnesses what other evidence there is. That's standard in all investigations, but they have had plenty of time to do that. And at this point, there's no reason to withhold this evidence. The public deserves to know. More importantly, the family deserves to know. And instead of any shred of evidence or explanation, the only thing we got was the immediate and selective narrative that was released by the GBI, and then silence. And so we are doing everything we can to get the evidence that is available.
And that narrative is supposedly that that Manuel had a Smith & Wesson gun that shot a trooper with, and that there's a ballistics match between the injured trooper and that gun. Has the family received any actual evidence or seen any actual evidence to back this up?
No.
And what about activists believing that friendly fire caused the trooper's injuries? One of the four body cam videos released by the Atlanta Police Department, APD, February 6, supports the assessment. In it, a police officer, an APD officer, can be heard remarking, "You effed your own guy up." a few minutes after the shooting. Can you explain that, Jeff?
I can't, because